For June 29th, 2017, it's the Lullabot Podcast. Hey, everybody. It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 213. I'm Matt Cleve, senior developer at Lullabot. With me, as always, co-host of the show, senior front-end developer Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Hey, so Mike, today we're talking about a pretty important topic when it comes to our web projects, right?
Yep, we're talking about accessibility and how that relates to Drupal.
Yeah, web accessibility, it really can be, you know, the line whether somebody can use your website or not.
And absolutely.
It's kind of an important thing, but a sad part is a lot of times we end up in projects where it's like, yeah, that's no problem. We don't have any time for that right now. We don't have any budget for that right now, right? We got to put that to the back burner.
Yep.
So we have some folks on the line today that some from Lullabot and some from not from Lullabot, some experts in the accessibility world, and they're going to tell us how it's done.
First up, we have one of the Drupal 8 core accessibility maintainers. He is the president of Open Concept Consulting. He has actually appeared on Lullabot podcast before on the Drupalize Me podcast in June of 2015 and has been on the Drupal Voices podcast back in the day.
Going way back.
Yeah, way back. Yeah. The owner of a black hoodle, which is a Wheaton Terrier poodle cross, who's sitting at his feet, evidently, and is from somewhere in the great white north, probably in an igloo somewhere. Welcome, Mike Gifford.
Thank you. I think the last time I was on, I was in the middle of construction, the building that we're in right now. So fortunately, the construction noises have stopped, and it should be a quieter, more peaceful interview.
That's good. The igloo is constructed.
Exactly.
Where is the Great White North?
We're in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. So okay. It's the nation's capital, and it's a good year because we're celebrating our 150th anniversary.
Right on. Also with us is one of the Accessibots. We have Helena McCabe along with us. She's a front-end developer here at Lullabot. She's often speaking about accessibility-related topics around Drupal conferences and otherwise. She's a dinosaur enthusiast and an owner of a brand-new golden retriever puppy from tropical Orlando, Florida. It's Helena McCabe. Hey.
Hi.
Glad you could join us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Anytime I have a chance to talk about accessibility, I will take it. So. Thank you.
And next up, we have a senior front-end developer here at Lullabot, has worked on accessibility-related topics in Backdrop CMS. He's an illustrator expert, but not the app, more like drawing stuff. I think he owns like a whole pack of dogs, because whenever I'm on a hangout with him, they're all over. He's from Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, Wes Ruvalcaba.
Hello.
Hey, Wes.
Four dogs right now. I'm up to four.
Oh, holy cow. How do you keep your house clean, Wes?
Right now I'm living with my mother-in-law, so fortunately she neurotically cleans, and I don't have to do too much.
That's a good answer.
It's a solid strategy.
Yep.
Okay, so Helena, you seem to be chomping at the bit to talk about accessibility. If you wouldn't mind just kind of giving us a one-minute overview. What are we talking about? What does it mean? Why is it important?
It's actually a really broad field when you say accessibility, because disability comes in so many different shapes and forms that there's no one right magic answer that's going to work for everything, because sometimes accessibility is mutually exclusive. But you were kind of saying how it's hard to sometimes get to it, or it gets deprioritized against other things. And I think a lot of that is because there's this myth that accessibility is an edge case. And they say, like, well, you know, we can't really go back and refactor all this for an edge case, or we can't take the time to do this right from the beginning for an edge case, which is ironic, because we have about 18.5 million more severely disabled people in the United States than there are people living in the entire state of New York. We've got 19.8 million, roughly, people living in New York, and we've got 38.3 million people in the United States with a severe disability. So, you know, if you told your client, oh, well, the site works fantastic, but it won't work in New York, they would freak out. Well, we can't launch it if it's not working in New York. So that's a really good thing to think about when you're considering if accessibility should be a priority or not. It's almost double the population of New York that you're ignoring when you skip it.
But it's also kind of a broad topic, though. All of these people who live in New York, your proverbial New York, don't necessarily have the same abilities or the same disabilities. You know, people are affected in different ways, and that also affects, you know, your needs when you're building a website, right?
Absolutely. We've got six main areas of disability of users who can benefit from accessibility, even though the truth is that it helps everyone. But you've got your visually impaired users who have may have something as simple as distinguishing between colors. So you need to look at your contrast and consider color blindness. You've got people who are completely blind, and you've got people who are severely visually impaired. You've got your motor impaired users who maybe can't use a mouse. Also, your blind users and your visually impaired users sometimes can't use a mouse because they can't see the cursor.
Or your Vim users.
Yes, or your Vim users who won't use a mouse. Ben, shout out.
I would definitely consider Vim to be a disability.
Oh, come on.
Harsh. Yeah, but your motor impaired users will need keyboard accessibility or be using a mouse stick. And then you have some that you don't think of, your vestibular users, a lot of scroll interactions and parallax effects for people with vestibular issues can make them very dizzy or make them seasick. So you don't want your users throwing up from your sight. We've got our deaf and hard of hearing users who benefit from captions and transcripts. People who have seizure disorders, who can actually have a seizure and be seriously injured if you have, you know, really bright flashing or anything like that on your sight. And you have your users with cognitive differences who may need more time to ingest the material or need more time to kind of parse what's happening or need more simple language. We don't want to exclude them either.
I like I like your analogy of the state of New York, but the one that I've been using more regularly is talking about the baby boomer population, which, you know, if you could say to your clients, are the baby boomers important to you as a user group? Is this a client base that you care about? Most of them would say that it is an area, a group that they care about, whether it's staff or whether it's board members or clients. So if you could look if we're lucky enough to get old, all of our abilities are going to get harder and harder to work with. Like our sight will diminish, our mobility will diminish, our ability to understand new concepts and to there's elements of aging that fall into learning disabilities. And so, if you can accommodate older populations, and a lot of older people are using the web. It's a misnomer that seniors do not use the web. Certainly they do. But I think that if we can remember that this is a population that in particular is struggling with accessibility challenges, even if they don't necessarily identify with having a disability.
Absolutely, Mike. That is such a good point. Yeah, absolutely. Especially with Alzheimer's, it's been shown that having a site with a layout that does not change and is very consistent can really help, you know, people with Alzheimer's and other memory issues be able to use that site even as their disability progresses.
Right. Or being able to just know where the navigational elements are and be able to track and successfully manage a site, like just even being able to to understand where the navigation elements, how they function. Jared Spool went and did a study on this a little while ago, I think, where he said that he was able to go off and track down the ability to understand information architecture with age and sort of track that progression with our inability to the brain's inability to sort of grab that new information and to manage that as easily as it would when you're even as young as 60 or 65.
I'm really glad you brought that up. Absolutely. Also, I spoke with a young woman named Sarah Ra, and she has Down syndrome. And she was saying that things like pop-ups that, you know, come up on the screen and pull her attention away can make the site really confusing, and she sort of loses focus on what she was doing. And I imagine that would likely apply as well.
I can speak from personal experience. Like, some of that just like affects me too, you know, pop-ups, and then you lose focus on what you're doing, what the heck was going on. And then also like navigation formats changing and stuff like that. Like, it's nice to have consistency across your website. A lot of those like interstitial ads and stuff like that, subscribe to our email address. That's like the bane of my web existence. I hate that. And I think, you know, it's interesting to hear that those become accessibility issues too.
There's a neat website that I like that that talks about the ABCs of accessibility and breaks it down into, you know, people who are on medication and or people who are juggling twins and trying to go off and navigate a website while they're thumbing through or holding two children, or there's all kinds of ways that we're distracted and we're trying to go off and to use this technology, whether it's out in the sun trying to be able to find out where a meeting is, or whether it's in a situation where we've injured our hands. Like, there's a lot of people who are blocked access from the website at all times, so we can't necessarily think about those, design for those opportunities where people are in a controlled environment with high speed internet and with a big screen that they're able to have a full featured experience focused on the device, because that's just not how people use technology these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
To quote Lullabot co-founder Jeff Robbins, when he was giving a talk once, he said something to the effect of, if your website user is driving 75 down the interstate, you can be assured that that person is visually impaired.
Yeah. Well,
that's true.
A lot of sense.
Yeah. So it's how you use the website as well. And, you know, these things are good for all kinds of different use cases.
For sure.
Yep. So I've read before, like there is some regulations, at least in the U.S., that mandate a certain amount of accessibility.
Yeah, and there are websites who are getting sued, right, for doing it wrong?
Yeah.
There definitely are, yeah. Successfully sued, not just, being sued just, as a...
Yeah, because everybody gets sued, right? Yeah, but...
That's right.
Lainey Feingold just had a blog post about a pretty landmark case that happened in Florida very recently where someone couldn't get to the coupons on the Winn-Dixie website. And there was a big lawsuit
being,
about it.
Grocery store in the South, yeah.
The coupons were on their website. It was the only way to access the specific coupon, as far as I understand. And, the user was visually impaired, and he said, I don't have equal access to these coupons. There's no reasonable accommodation for me. This isn't right. And he fought it.
That's pretty interesting. You think it would be easier for Winn-Dixie just to fix their website as opposed to paying lawyers' fees?
Yeah.
Yeah, lawyers are always going to be more expensive than web developers. No matter how, even if you find a really excellent web developer, they're still probably going to be cheaper than a reasonable lawyer. But you're absolutely right. There's two legal frameworks that have changed recently in the United States. One is the Section 508, which had, under the last few days of Obama's administration, he updated the Section 508 guidelines and moved that to look at meeting the WCAG, the WCAG 2.0 AA requirements. So instead of the U.S. maintaining its own standards, and the Section 508 standards were written in 1997, so these are really old documents that really don't apply to how the web works these days. So it's refreshing that this change came in, and almost every other country in the world has moved to the World Wide Web Consortium's WCAG guidelines. So it's a great step ahead for the United States. For organizations that get federal money or work for the federal government, they need to be Section 508 compliant. And now that means they need to go off and start being aware of things like color contrast and making sure that the page order is managed properly, so that there's an appropriate tab order when you're navigating through websites. And that's really useful. Now, there's a possibility that Trump could try and step on that I don't think that'll happen. I haven't heard anything about this legislation getting rolled back, and it will become in law in January of 2018. So looking forward to that finally being addressed and not putting the legislation around accessibility in the web back another, like, it took 8 years or more to go off and to get for the Section 508 refresh process to be completed. And it'd be good if this was just done and settled. But the bigger one, like the Winn-Dixie case, was actually not looking at this at Section 508. It was looking at the Americans with a Disability Act, and the ADA was set up to apply for a much broader range of organizations. So anyone that is any private business or organization, if it's not a church or a private club, I think that any organization falls under the the ADA guidelines, which means that you have to provide accommodations for people. And the recent decision of the Department of Justice was that this guideline would be following the that they would move from the Section 508 guidelines to the WCAG guidelines. So WCAG 2.0 AA is the law of the land under the Americans with a Disability Act at this point.
Okay. So regarding like the Section 508 stuff, does that just also affect websites for public entities, or could that affect my blog or anything else?
It won't affect your blog. If it's a personal blog, you're not likely to be affected. But it will affect anyone that gets money from the federal government or anyone who is working for the federal government. So if Lilibot works with the federal government and Lilibot's blog should be following the WCAG CAG 2.0 AA guidelines in January, mm-hmm. Simply because you're a contractor for the federal government. Assuming you are, but if it's a personal blog or it's a blog for a private club, you won't necessarily need to be doing that, or you shouldn't need to do that. But for if you're blogging for, let's say, the blog of a commercial entity like IBM's blog, that would need, as I understand it, would need to be accessible based on the precedents that have happened with the Department of Justice at this point.
Gotcha. There's also some murkiness there on at what point are you publicly funded. There have been some lawsuits that have happened with universities around the country that argue, well, we're a private institution, but they take federal funding dollars from grants. And at that point, because you have taken federal money toward a grant, you are partially publicly funded, which means that they are also required to be accessible. And so some lawsuits have cropped up in that gray area as well.
But now with the ADA also moving to look at WCAG guidelines, that shouldn't be an issue, because whether or not they get money from the government or not isn't really that relevant. If there's also this other set of guidelines that suggests that if you're serving the public and you need to go off and make your public physical spaces accessible, which universities do, that you also need to make sure that your web spaces are also accessible.
That's the really exciting thing about this lawsuit that just happened, is it's the first federal trial in the United States on website accessibility. So that sets legal precedent for the entire country, because we've had these things happen, especially in California, where they have stronger, more robust ADA laws. But to have a federal case come through, and the really interesting part about this is that it was ruled that even third-party components and tools on the website, so if you get a widget off the internet that you incorporate into your site or a module that is not accessible, you still have a certain amount of responsibility to select tools that are accessible or to fix them so that they are before that site goes up. So you can't wash your hands of it and say, well, we didn't build that tool. You are still responsible.
What exactly is in the WCAG? Do they say, I heard earlier they were talking about contrast. Do they specify that it must pass like a certain test? Does it just give general outlines where it says you must be able to tab through stuff, or how specific is it?
It's designed to be as future compatible as possible. Like, one of the problems with Section 508 was that it was very technology specific. It was geared for the web of 1997. So mm-hmm. JavaScript at the time was a problem. Now all screen readers go off and work on the DOM. So JavaScript isn't necessarily a problem. But part of Section 508 is the old Section 508 is still that your site needs to work without JavaScript. Now you might want to do that for security reasons, but there's no reason that you would want to do that for accessibility reasons, because all of the screen readers are working on the DOM. But I think that in terms of the guidelines, generally you want to make sure that the WCAG has broken it down into the sites being perceivable, operable, understandable and robust. So can you see the information? Can you interact with the web forms and the navigation? Can you, is it written in a mechanism that you can understand it? And is it structured enough so that, that you can use it with a variety of different devices in a variety of different contexts? Is it a robust interface that will work for more than a scattered set of use cases?
Who can decide if it's robust or not, though? Who makes that decision?
So there's the guidelines are discussed by the WC3 committee. So the, mm-hmm. the people from Google and Microsoft and the Mozilla Foundation get together and discuss what standards they want to include and how the browsers are going to support them, and make sure that the guidelines are testable. And like there's WCAG 2.0 was implemented in 2008. There's now discussions about creating WCAG 2.1 because it's now almost a decade old. And there's a lot of stuff that they missed in 2.0, and they're negotiating to fit into 2.1. And 2.1 will be backward compatible. It'll fit within the framework of the POR framework, perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. But it's essentially as a committee of people that sit down and debate the language and the context, and then try to bring in specific use cases to go off and evaluate whether that technology, like how you would do this. So there's within the WCAG website, you can see examples of how to go off and implement an accessible table framework or an accessible how to go off and to manage a skip link. Like there's documentation about a lot of the guidelines within the guidelines.
The other trick, when you say what are the guidelines of the WCAG, the trick is that there are levels to it. So you can't just say, well, this is WCAG, because they have level A, double A, triple A. And for instance, with your text contrast, if you want to be double A compliant, your large scale text needs to have a contrast ratio of at least 3:1. But if you want to be triple A compliant, then you're talking about a contrast ratio of 4:5:1. So it changes based on the level of accessibility that you're going for.
And triple A is if you ever see an RFP that's asking for a website to be AAA compliant, basically that's not possible. I don't think there's any examples of any complex website that meets all of those requirements. They're really aspirational. The AAA guidelines are there to help encourage people to take the next step, and particularly to get to know their user base better, to find out how they can better meet the needs of their user base. So, if you're dealing with the senior population, a senior group might be benefiting more from increased color contrast and more attention to color contrast. Whereas if you're dealing with an audience that might have a higher rate of dyslexia, you might find that the user base actually wants to have less contrast, and that you need to go off and build in less contrast to see that users with dyslexia can more easily read the content.
Or that dyslexia font.
Although I've heard some studies that doesn't actually work really? So well, that the dyslexia font, as cool as it is, at least in the only controlled user case that I've heard about, it didn't actually provide any useful advantage to people with disabilities. They did not continue to use the dyslexia font to even after training and support work, they didn't continue to use it.
Oh, that's a bummer.
What is the dyslexia font?
The idea behind the dyslexia font was that it would be easier for some users with dyslexia to go off and to read text if it was weighted more, so the bottom was heavier. So you can always know if you get your B's and D's mixed up and your you could structure it so that it it was clear, it was consistently structured so that you could use other mechanisms to determine whether it was a B or a D, and to understand, or a P or a, I guess a P and a D, to understand which is the heavy part. And that they, there's a number of open dyslexic fonts that have been developed over the years, and they look good, but I haven't heard, you know, the Dyslexic Association calling for the use of this. And I don't know that it has really met a big need in the user community.
Interesting.
So it's good that we're trying that, but we may not be there yet. So, you know, maybe someone else will come up with the font that everyone needs. There's, you know, it's great that people are making the attempt.
And I think the most interesting thing is about trying to allow for greater personalization. If you can build your website so that a user can insert their own style sheet and override your style sheets, maybe it is useful for them to have the dyslexia font, or perhaps it's better for them to go off and to have a font that they've created for themselves, or that they want a contrast spectrum that works better for their eyes. If you can design your website so that a user can select their own whether or not it's in one column or two columns, like you can give users that a level of personalization that makes it much easier for them to be able to meet their expectation and their needs. The BBC in the UK, the British Broadcasting Fund, has done a lot of work on trying to create that level of personalization within their own website, and to build out a framework that allows people to, you know, maybe they have autism, or maybe they have, they're somewhere on that spectrum. They need to have the content structured in a different way to make it easier for them. We should be able to allow users to be able to easily consume information in a way that's the best for them.
Media Current did something cool like that recently, to a lesser extent. You know, it's a client project, so you don't have endless time. But what they did was to balance design demands against accessibility, because sometimes those are mutually exclusive. They created an accessibility toolbar in a client site that they built. So if you needed, it had some buttons for different modes. There was like a high contrast mode. There was like a large letter mode. And you could click the toolbar to set this site for your needs if you had any special needs that way, which I thought was a really cool way to compromise between, you know, what the designers want and what someone else might actually need.
That's a cool way, but I've always thought, well, why aren't there media queries that do this type of stuff? What Media Current did right there seems like a shim for what should be maybe part of some type of standard, where I can maybe select, I can create a media query that says, you know, high contrast ratio, that actually might be one, or like, say, like, I don't know.
So it could be a browser setting that says like, hey, I have a visual disability. That would be cool.
Yeah. And I mean,
I don't know that, like, unfortunately, there's no way that the browser or the content management system can know, because the browser doesn't collect that information. The screen reader doesn't have its own built-in browser. It works with whatever browser, like any other app on the desktop. So there will be some that work better with Chrome, some that work better with Firefox. They change with version to version. And all of that information is hidden from the content management system. It's not exposed at all.
There's ways that it could happen, though. You know, like, for example, there could be like a hidden element, or like a hidden JavaScript object or something like that the applications could parse. And at that point, you know, realize that, hey, this needs to be XYZ or something like that. Like, if there was some type of setting within the browser that could, like, activate a media query that would, you know, maybe give larger text for someone that does have visual impairment.
Maybe even a Chrome plugin that could do that universally, that says, like, hey, you know, I need high contrast, and it would kind of parse the CSS on the page and look for things that are not enough contrast and bump it up or something like that. I'm not a software developer.
Sounds like a magical place. Let's get started.
There are some people that are working on building a central site that would keep your personal information in it. That would, like, if you want to have your font type at a, like a 20 want, and you want to be able to have the color contrast set at this, and you want to make sure that you're you can define that you'd be allowed to define a lot of those personal elements about, you know, how images are displayed and how you're certainly the color contrast is one that's useful that could be centralized. And then your website would be able to potentially in your browser, you could identify yourself to some degree and be able to have the content management system look up this external resource and say, okay, let's make sure the website looks good in with these elements. And if you're using the Windows high contrast, important part for you to navigate the information, we're going to go off and optimize it for Windows high contrast mode and manage that process. But there hasn't been a lot of movement in that recently that I've seen.
Yeah.
Talk about accessibility and some of the requirements that web developers are building for. We'll talk about how that relates to Drupal and what web developers can do to make sure they're doing it right. Coming up right after this. Fancy seeing you guys here.
Yeah.
These look like the Drupal Camp Colorado organizers or something.
Or something.
Yep.
And Mike Herschel.
And Mike Herschel.
Man, I want to go to Drupal Camp Colorado too. I don't have that much vacation days though. Because I went to Spain, I only have like 3 days left.
The good news is that Drupal Camp Colorado happens on the weekend, Mike. So if you could fly out on Friday, you might be able to return on Monday. You could work remotely in airports and stuff. You don't need to take vacation days to go to Drupal Camp Colorado.
But dude, all right, dude, we just recorded our promo. Thanks, guys.
All right, and that's a wrap. Yeah, so what are we talking about again?
Whatever you Colorado? Want to talk about. Yeah, so Drupal Camp Colorado coming up.
And Drupal Camp Colorado is coming up. You were right about that part. It's July 28th, 29th, and 30th. Training on the 28th. And sessions 29th and 30th. That's Friday and Saturday. So you can get your hiking on Friday if you don't want to go to training. You can go hiking on Monday or Tuesday. And you have the weekend to soak up Drupal knowledge.
So sessions are both on Saturday and Sunday?
Uh-huh.
And we have some kick-ass keynotes this year, too.
We do. That's right. We have Jeffrey A., Jam McGuire from Acquia, and we have Adam Bergstein from Civic Actions.
Nice.
The other thing I want to say is it's really important to know that session submissions close on June 30th, and that is not that far away.
What do you want to see submissions on? What topics?
I think that's a great question, because with Drupal 8 out, it's more than just Drupal code now. We've got Symfony. We've got a lot of different front-end libraries that we want to learn about and talk about. Twig, for example, I know absolutely nothing about and I need to learn about, and I've been doing Drupal for 10 years. So I want to see sessions submitted ranging from all these new front-end things, all these new libraries, these new pieces that are coming in for Drupal 8, how you build a site, just site building in Drupal 8, which is a little bit different than 7. How to do custom modules. There's some deep dive stuff we could get into. And then there's what's been really popular at DrupalCons lately is the being human tracks, just how you're dealing with being in Drupal or being in tech, trying to learn Drupal 8 when all you've done is Drupal 7 for the last 6 years. If you know anything, if you've done anything in Drupal, there's always somebody who doesn't know something that you do know, and you can teach it to them.
Drupal Camp Colorado, July 28th through the 30th, downtown Denver. It's going to be great.
Let me go to flights.google.com and just.
I knew we'd talk him into it. He's looking now. We're going to get him.
Welcome back. We're talking accessibility on the Lullabot podcast, and we have several different accessibility experts here. Let's move into more of the practical side. Like, as a website developer, what do we need to do, and how are things different within various content management systems, and say, even between Drupal 8 and Drupal 7? I'll let you start,
sure.
Mike, since you're one of the current maintainers.
I think that in terms of what developers need to be thinking about, I think that far too often people jump to, oh, I need to test this in VoiceOver. I need to test this with a screen reader. And generally, if you're a sighted user, and particularly if you're somebody who's developed the website, that's not a good place to start. It takes too much time to learn how to use a screen reader properly. And if a sighted user is using a screen reader to try and navigate an element that they already know very well, it's not a very good emulation option for somebody who's an end user who's trying to go off and navigate through the site. So tell people is to use the automated tools. So there are some amazing automated tools out there that will help developers and, for that matter, clients and content authors look at their content. So the Wave toolbar is useful. Tenon.io is very useful. There's some great tools that in the browser that allow you to quickly test whether or not there's color contrast and whether or not that is sufficient or not. So much of the time, the accessibility problems are, there's low-hanging fruit out there for accessibility. So just like not having alt tags for images or not having the forms built in a semantic structured way. So those are things that automated tools are really great at testing out. The other tool that I think is the system that is really quite accessible that I think everyone should be able to do and should be doing as part of the testing process is just tabbing through the website. So if you're looking at your website and you're trying to navigate your website without a mouse, so much of the time you can't even find out where you are. Occasionally where you are on the screen will display focus, but often the designers build websites and think only about mouse interactions and are not thinking about the keyboard only interactions. So you're not necessarily sure where you are and how to go off and what the actions are of hitting return on a page. So building your skip links in there and making sure your menus are navigable and that as that focus is thought through in your design, that if there's a design element for a mouse and for a hover state, that you've made an even bigger focus for a keyboard only state, because there's a lot more people who use the keyboard only than who are using screen readers and making sure that your site is as available as possible for that. Once you've done those two things, then you can start looking at how to learning how to do screen reader testing. But it's probably better for most organizations to reach out to bodies that actually employ people with disabilities to do that testing for them, and to engage with either an accessibility expert to do that third party testing, or to organizations like Lighthouse that would be able to provide a professional evaluation for how accessible your content actually is to screen readers. In terms of Drupal 7 and Drupal 8, mm-hmm. Drupal 7 was the most accessible content management system at its time, and it still, I think, holds out as being the best for its era of content management systems. Drupal 8 is much more accessible than that, particularly since we brought in Views and Views UI into core, and both of those have seen substantial improvements to how they're constructed, and we've both in terms of the user interface, so that people who have disabilities can navigate and administer and edit content within the website, but also the output of it is more accessible as well. Things where we've built in best practices for building accessible content and making sure that it's semantically outlined in the content structure. So this is a big step forward for Drupal 8. And the other thing we've added is we've talked a lot about the web content accessibility guidelines, but there's another set of WC3 guidelines, which is the authoring tool accessibility guidelines. And ATAG has elements for how do we make sure that the content management system helps content authors produce more accessible content, and we've added some elements in Drupal 8 to help deal with that, to guide the content authors along in producing more accessible web pages.
And sometimes when we think about users, when we think about accessibility, we consider our users. Is it accessible to users? But another important consideration that D8 did really well is we considered that it's not just users who have disabilities, it's developers. There's also software and web developers who have disabilities as well that would like to be able to use these tools. And I actually interviewed one such software developer. His name is Mike, and he works for Lighthouse. And what Mike Fox told me, he's visually impaired, And this was without any cajoling from my end. No hints. He didn't even know that I was interviewing him for a Drupal conference. But he mentioned that Drupal 8, he had been really excited for the release of, because he had heard that the editorial tools would work well for people with disabilities, and that he was very pleased, and that it's really, really fantastic for him being accessible out of the box, for him to be able to build websites and have his needs met, not just from a user standpoint, but from a developer standpoint as well.
Yeah, it's pretty important, because you don't want to lock people with various disabilities out of their jobs, you know, particularly even a skill set. I think that's hugely important.
I'm trying to imagine that, though. Gosh, I mean, looking at the interface to building a view, I mean, it's very visual the way it's laid out. And I can't imagine listening to a screen reader and finding all the options.
Apparently, it can be very done.
The way that we've done it in Drupal 8 is to try and make sure that we've exposed the navigation as much as possible. So often the way that people with disabilities go off, or people who are blind and using screen readers, browse, is that they look for stepping stones to help them understand the structure of the content. So the various different headings that we've set up that identify blocks of content, or the links, making sure the link titles are organized properly. And also WAI's area implementation in another number of places to be able to, again, structure the content. So we give these navigational stepping stones to users with disabilities to allow them to read and understand the information. And they also, when you're users who are using screen readers often will parse the web pages much faster than most of us can understand it. And they're used to reading web pages much faster than two or three times. I'm not sure what the average is in terms of the reading speed, but we can learn to understand content at a much, much faster speed if you're blind than you can if you're not used to that. So people will often read a page over again, and then zoom into a particular section of the website to go off and to read it again to get more information and navigate through that website in a way to be able to even gather information or complex information and pull together more complex information.
Wes Ruvel Kabba, we haven't heard from you yet. You've done some accessibility work on Backdrop, which is a fork of Drupal. Can you tell us about that? What have you done, and what challenges did you run into, and how did you test it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the first thing was make the font size in the admin theme not small, which is always a big annoyance of mine. So that we redid the admin theme, and except for a few areas, the font size is 16, which I enjoy. And then the next big feature we had that really had a lot of potential accessibility issues was the responsive menus out of core. So giving people a drop-down menu implementation that was also responsive, went down to like a hamburger or something, and was usable with people with different potential issues. So, the thing that came up with that, or that we ended up doing, evaluating a lot of third-party frameworks, and I was worried I'd have to make my own thing because it had to A, work with the markup that was coming out of core more or less. And then it would also have to be accessible, which a lot of jQuery plugins or things like that don't take that into account. We did actually end up finding one. And I should have looked up the name of it, actually.
Well, anyone can go to Backdrop Core and find it.
yes. It was a jQuery plugin. Keyboard functionality is fantastic. Then you just have the basic ARIA, or not ARIA rules, but HTML5, nav tags and stuff like that to help people get there, and then the skip to menu kind of stuff. to kind of cover the rest, which is kind of already baked in since, you know, it's very Drupal 7, like most of the way through its life cycle, it's the Drupal 7 kind of markup and stuff like that with the HTML5 improvements. But yeah, and I think it's been pretty successful, but like we've only tested it, you know, and just like kind of Mike was recommending that you generally test stuff like just keyboard stuff and then just kind of looking at best practices that we know of about, you know, how you use tags or ARIA attributes or that kind of thing. I think we had ARIA attribute for the hamburger. I can't remember which one because I always have to Google them every single time. But yeah, it's a really fun experience.
ARIA is an interesting one because often developers, especially if they're trying to go off and deal with a legacy tool, will just they'll look up the ARIA and they'll insert some tags. And there are people who've actually used ARIA and made their website less accessible because of they've added ARIA inappropriately. So the first rule of ARIA is don't use ARIA. Use HTML5. They're semantic. If you can convey the information semantically, use HTML5 for that. The other mistake is that often people will use automated tools exclusively and not do any other testing. And as good as automated tools are, they only really catch about 20% of the errors. So it's useful for the low hanging fruit, but it's not something that you can use to catch everything. But it's you know, really great that there's libraries out there that are being developed for accessibility now.
And I think the only thing that I couldn't catch with just generic, you know, with just HTML5 tags was the hamburger menu controls the visibility of the menu. And that was some, I think I was ARIA controls and, our ARIA owns, I think was the two. I don't know if that's the right one, right. But I think that's what I ended up going with. It seemed the most appropriate.
The other thing is just to be able to reach out to a user base and to try and get some interaction with people. There's certainly, if you're looking to get feedback for your website, then you know, trying to go off and reach out to a groups like the NFB to try and have some help. That isn't the right place. You should really hire somebody that has the skills to be able to do that. But if you're building something like Backdrop or Drupal or WordPress and you have a problem, if you're fixing the problems with the core functionality of these websites, it can benefit, you know, millions of people if you can address it properly. So I don't think it's a problem to go off and to reach out and say, hey, we'd love to work with somebody and get some testing so that this tool that you know, maybe even the NFB is using, could be improved and could be made more accessible for your members.
How are modern JavaScript frameworks accessibility wise, like React, Angular, Ember, Vue, etc.?
They're not great. Some of them are okay, but I don't know that like if you move to a headless framework, you're really, a lot of the work that's being done in Drupal 7 and Drupal 8 is it'll be thrown out because the HTML is being ignored. Now that there are, I have heard good reviews from people who've looked at I'm not sure if it was React or Angular. Like there are some good implementations out there, but don't assume that it'll just work with either of those frameworks. You have to basically start from scratch. Yeah.
Dojo is known to be a really good JavaScript framework for accessibility. I haven't personally used it myself, but it was developed with accessibility in mind, and its documentation even lists all the navigation keys and known issues with different assistive technologies. And it has some accessible UI widgets right out of the box.
Wait a minute. A JavaScript framework that has good documentation? What is this called again?
Rumor has it. Yeah, it's called Dojo.
What are the issues that we see with some of these frameworks? Explain the problems.
I think it's mostly that you have to start from scratch. Like Drupal, you have a really good base to work from. But if using React, it's like now the onus is all back on you to do it correctly.
Okay.
And a lot of times these frameworks just use everything is stuck within a div, and those divs are styled, and you can throw labels, you can throw area at it to go off and to make it semantically accurate, but it's not converting those divs into actual HTML5, which is better supported in the browser. It's just is done through a simple, rather simple implementation and more design focused than it is semantically focused.
Yeah, with React at least, that's not necessarily the case. But one of the issues I do see come up a lot is that it with React specifically, it's what I have more experience with, is that when you're working with something that in a component scale, rather than like Drupal and a lot of systems are composing on a little bit of larger component or page scale, is that it's harder to get the markup correct because you don't necessarily know where this component will show up. So having, you know, like a well-composed article that has the article tag and header and footer and everything, you know, has the right markup might not be as easy because a smaller component could be used in so many different contexts that oftentimes I see developers just go with more generic stuff, which is just not as good for so many reasons. But I think that's just kind of a part of the paradigm shift and getting used to the new world and you know, we'll get better at it. But I think that's a problem that comes up a lot.
I think context is really important. Wes, you were talking about, you know, you didn't exactly know where this was going to be used. And I think you could probably do everything right within the realm of a CSS, CMS rather. You could do everything right as far as if I'm building a CMS and I'm building out this structure of this website and how it's going to be. And if users and editors don't use it right, it could still be a train wreck, right?
Yeah, editorial experience with accessibility is a big deal because oftentimes in the long run, if you do everything right, like you said, building it, making sure that you make it easy, as easy as possible for the editors to continue the good work of adding alt attributes and making sure that the content is accessible. And then also training them to kind of know when they need to add stuff. Or even like if you can get them to use the Wave tool. I think the Wave tool will catch most of the things that content editors would need to be responsible for. Does that sound right?
The trick there is that human consideration is also important. When we talk about the port principles, the reality is that there's no magic list where if you do everything on this list, your site will be accessible because it takes some human common sense. There's no list that can account for everything. For instance, I recently worked on a site where we had a lot of tags for blog posts. And while that link text on the tags is technically correct and it's audible, you know, it's keyword accessible, it could be really confusing for someone to hear these tag link titles without any context being provided because it just sounds like a string of links to random words at the top of the article. So in a case like that, for instance, it would be a good idea to put some kind of audible cue that, hey, these are tags. So it's not about just hitting a checklist. It's also about thinking about what you're doing and how that will be perceived without all of the context that someone might have.
So how would you do that? Would you add like an element invisible tag or something like that? Or
that's so Drupal 7, man. So Drupal 7.
Right?
I am so on Drupal 7. My Drupal 7 is showing.
No, so, I would probably add something in the audio to indicate that it's a tag. And it wouldn't have to be something visible, but so something that would show up for the screen reader that says, hey, this is a tag.
How does that work?
But how would I do that? Would I just like, you know, I know that there's, you know, like the element invisible tag within Drupal 7, you like hid the element visually, but it made it available to screen readers and stuff like that. Unless I mean,
there's always more than one way to skin a cat. You could put an element invisible heading on that region that says, hey, this is the tags region. You could put an invisible chunk of text before the link that says tag : blah, blah, blah. There's always more than one way to do something.
Okay. That makes sense.
I was going to say that in terms of the problem of unleashing content editors on a content management system is that often there are things that we even restrict them from doing. In Drupal 7, it still is difficult if you have a phrase that's in a different language and you want to go off and include that. With screen readers, you need to actually tell them that you're switching languages. You need to define the language at the top of the page so that the screen reader knows what language to read it in. But if you have a phrase in there like je ne sais quoi, or you need to be able to qu'est-ce que c'est, or like you throw a French word in there. Mm-hmm. If you want it to be read properly, you need to go off and create a span and define that the language is different than the default page, like lang equals fr for that element. And we've made that easier in Drupal 8 as part of a tag. So now there's a button that you can enable that allows you to have that as part of the user interface.
What does that do actually for the screen reader?
What it does is it means the screen reader switches the dictionary sets. So instead of using a English dictionary to speak the word, it uses a French dictionary to speak the word. So
it's a pronunciation.
It's a pronunciation dictionary. So yeah, they pronounce the words properly.
So it's not like the robot gets a different accent or anything. It just actually works in the right language and makes sense if you're hearing it.
It just works in the right language. Okay. Yeah. And the other one is spell check is now built into Drupal 8 as well, because misspelled words are hard to pronounce properly. And whether you're dealing with somebody who's whose English is a second language and they may have trouble knowing, is this actually a new word or is this something that is actually, you know, is this a misspelled word? If you've cleaned up your content and your content editors are using the words that they mean to be using, then you're going to make it more understandable for everyone.
Helena, you've mentioned something a couple of times and I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about it because I think it sounds interesting. It sounds like you've done a bunch of interviews with people.
Yes, yeah. I have.
So tell me about that. How'd you come across that? What'd you talk about? What'd you learn?
Well, the purpose of doing that was that as an able-bodied user myself, and a lot of accessibility specialists in our field are able-bodied users, I didn't want to be doing this work off of conjecture. I didn't want it to be my assumption of someone else's experience shaping the work that I do, because ultimately the work that I do is not for me. So it was really important to me to get that perspective and find out firsthand, where are we going wrong? What could we be doing better? Why? Please give me your experience. So I interviewed people with hearing disabilities, people with visual impairments, people with cognitive disabilities, pretty much any sect of disability that I could get my hands on to interview someone, I did. And it was a lot of interviews and it was very enjoyable because I met a lot of wonderful people that way.
And it allowed you to do a kick-ass keynote as well. So,
why, thank you.
and is the link available to that to be available? That was recorded, wasn't it?
It was. I believe it's up on YouTube. I do also believe that the captions are egregious. They are the automatic captions. Apologize in advance.
Oh, the irony.
I have no control over the YouTube video. It's not under my account, so I don't believe I can fix the captions. But I do have my slides, so if anyone is unable to hear on that video, please reach out to me, and I will send you the slides so that you can at least have that transcript.
We can throw the video link into the bottom of the show notes for everybody.
Thank you.
So if I am interested in web accessibility, who should I follow on Twitter? How do I learn about more of this type of stuff?
Well, Mike Gifford, obviously.
Helena, obviously.
WebAIM is a really good one.
Okay.
You said WebAIM?
Yeah, WebAX also has a bunch of great links. WebAX is a great space to learn from Twitter.
Yes, and they have their AX chat that goes on every now and again, and it's a big accessibility Twitter fest with questions and lots of people weighing in, and that's always a really fascinating thing to catch.
That's WebAXE, like the tool you're going to split wood with.
Do not miss Axe Chat.
The other thing to look out for is there's unconferences or camps for accessibility that are organized around the world, and so it's worthwhile trying to find when those are and try and go to one, because it's useful to learn about web accessibility from other experts in the field, but also from people who have disabilities, so to participate in those. And there's also every May 18th, there's a Global Accessibility Awareness Day. Actually, it's not every 18th, but I think it's the third Thursday in the month or something like that is Global Accessibility Awareness Day. And that's a great space to learn as well and to follow people who are part of that. And there's a whole bunch of videos that are available on Inclusive Design 24. There's videos on Drupal and WordPress and on government implementations and usability, and Inclusive Design 24 is a great reference as well.
And Marcy Sutton has a blog, allywins.tumblr.com, and it's a bunch of websites that she showcases that are really great with accessibility while still looking really nice. So that is worth checking out.
And Marcy's also been a real leader in JavaScript frameworks as well. So she's done a lot to try and push those frameworks to be more accessible.
Hmm. She's pretty much amazing.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. So, accessibility audits. I know Lullabot has given those, correct, with you, Helena?
Indeed. I didn't get to do the audit, ironically. Okay. I was actually kind of bummed that I didn't get that project. But Danny did it, and he did a really great job setting up the Pali dashboard for the client. Awesome. But now, I did get to teach them. I got to do the in-house teaching, so okay. I got to go in and do that.
And Mike, does Open Concept also do accessibility consulting?
We do. We've done that for a number of clients in the past, and generally work on Drupal, but not exclusively. Okay. We generally look at doing reviews and think that reviews are we have a number of contacts who will do more extensive audits, and our team is focused more on trying to make sure that we're building good tools and that we're focused. An audit often is sort of like the difference between a if you're writing a book, you'll go and take it to a third party to go off and to have it be edited. And we definitely feel that there's people who are who focus exclusively on doing that level of editing for accessibility. And the other thing that's interesting about accessibility is that it keeps changing. The tools keep changing and keep getting updated. And particularly for things like mobile accessibility, there's elements where people there's just a lot to keep track of and keep up to date with, and so I often refer a full audit to somebody else.
The best audit you can get is from a person who has an actual disability. If you're a sighted person, you'll never be as good at using a screen reader as a blind person. It's if you can find someone with a disability to do your accessibility audit, they're your best bet.
And there's even going to be differences from people who are blind at birth and people who've become blind later in life, because some concepts you can't, it's hard to learn if you've been blind from birth. If you don't have any visual reference for how a page would be constructed, it's difficult to be able to learn that.
There's a lot of variance, even just, if you've met a disabled person, you've met one person with a disability.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on to talk about accessibility and evangelizing accessibility.
No problem. It's been wonderful chatting.
All right. Hold on, I'm going to pause you there. I'm hearing breathing from somebody. I don't know. I can't tell who it's from.
Darth Vader.